is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A tropical storm becomes a Cat 4 Hurricane Helene in 48 hours, the largest monster to ever hit Florida's panhandle. Credit record hot waters in the Gulf of Mexico long after summer has passed. This week's guest, Vandana Shiva, says it is no longer climate change. It is climate havoc. In our second half hour, University of California Distinguished Professor Michael Prather explains methane stays in the atmosphere longer than we were told. Dr. Michael Polanyi on Logging Industry Myths Canada tells the world more self-delusion on the real emissions driving disruption in the atmosphere. I'm Alex Smith with three interviews. Let's go. If this civilization is suicidal, who will tell us? Do humans have to live this way? Over decades, Indian scholar and activist Vandana Shiva answers. Dr. Shiva trained in atomic research with a Canadian doctorate. She is based in Delhi, but works with groups all over the world. Vandana is an environmental activist, food sovereignty advocate, eco-feminist, and anti-globalization leader. Her core base begins with food, from natural production to healthy bodies and societies. Now Dr. Shiva adds to 20 previous books with a new must-read work called The Nature of Nature, The Metabolic Disorder of Climate Change. From Delhi, India, Vandana Shiva, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
New readers encountering you for the first time might find it a little shocking. Do you think people in developed countries, including some environmentalists, are living in kind of a bubble of self-serving myths?
For sure. The big financing to organized environmental groups, which are different from the movement, has become narrower and narrower and shallower and shallower. And the ecological issues have kind of disappeared to the background, which is why I've written this book, Nature of Nature, to just wake us up to the fact that we are living on a living planet.
And among those myths that you expose in your book are international treaties supposed to protect the environment. You cite the Convention on Biodiversity, but you also talk about the annual COP climate change meetings. We have a lot of climate listeners. Could you tell us how that climate process has been twisted?
So, 92 is when, basically under the pressure of the international movements, which had big people's movements, and our Common Future Report of Gro Harlem Brundtland, commissioned by the United Nations, United Nations meeting was organized at the Rio, called the Earth Summit, and two treaties, legally binding treaties, were created. One was to protect the biodiversity, species diversity of this planet and the obligations of states. Obligations included protecting what they have, recognizing the rights of traditional people. And the clause that I've personally worked very hard on is a clause to regulate GMOs because they have an impact on biodiversity, public health and livelihoods. The second treaty was the Treaty of the Climate, UN Framework on Climate Change. And originally, both were thought of as interconnected. And it's the South, the so-called developing countries, that really drove both of them. The North was constantly avoiding. Mr. Bush Sr. said, we will not have regulation of biotech because I don't want my industry to lose. But when they see responsibility to the environment and to people as a loss to companies, we've got the wrong model of business and industry. What has happened since 92 is first a separation between the climate treaty and the biodiversity treaty, even though the climate is created by the biosphere and regulated by the biosphere. And there's a big discussion going on in the United States right now on the chronic diseases and metabolic disorders that humans are suffering because of a bad food system. But this book points out that that same bad food system, which is a fossil fuel system, a fossil chemical system, is also leading to the metabolic disasters for the Earth. Climate change should be seen as a metabolic disaster of planet Earth.
The most recent climate conference, COP28 in the United Arab Emirates, was about our climate future, not agriculture. That was its stated purpose. But you say the future of food was also front and center at COP28. How so?
You know, I was invited a few times to the United Arab Emirates because they were preparing for the COP with a focus on food. Of course, it's a desert, not the best place to learn about diversity of life. Yeah, you need to come to countries like India to learn how the desert ecology and the rainforest ecology and the coastal ecology are all different. COP in the Arab countries turned out to be driving us further and faster down the road of a destructive agriculture model because it's centered on fossil fuels, leading to metabolic diseases of human beings and the climate disaster. Is Mr. Gates. It was the head of an oil agency who was the president. Now, usually, government people who are presidents, never corporate employees, and definitely not the corporations who are at the center of the debate, the fossil fuel industry. And of course, they push a more energy-intensive, more long-distance supply system, which is exactly what has brought us to the crisis. 50% emissions that are accounted for from industrial globalized agriculture. 50%. 14% from production. Another 20% by destroying forests for soybean and palm oil. Another 20% for turning good food into trash, the junk food industry, the processing industry, the food miles, the packaging. And then the waste that comes from a globalized industrialized system, which must be based on uniformity. You know, I wrote a book called Oneness versus 1% because I witnessed Mr. Gates, who's the biggest farmland owner of America today. Most people don't realize it. He started something called Gates Ag One. He wants one agriculture for the whole world, and he wants to. So I wrote a book called Oneness versus 1% when I watched the Paris COP being taken over by him, and he did it all over again.
A destabilized climate has burned India this year with long-lasting record heat waves, drought in some places, and unbelievable rains and floods in other parts of the country. Could you tell us about extreme weather in your part of the world?
You see, the Indian subcontinent is on the one hand most beautifully endowed by nature. You know, we've got the third pole of snow in the Himalaya. We've got the deserts of the Thar and the Rajasthan. We've got the rainforests along the western parts. We were the semi-arid tracts in the peninsula. But we are the most affected by climate havoc, even though historically India, not being an industrialized country, is not a historic polluter for whom the original treaty was written. How does climate havoc, I call it climate havoc, I don't call it change, because change lulls you into thinking, oh, a predictable 1 degree increase. No. No, climate havoc is you don't know. One day you'll have heat that is unbearable. The next day you're going to have a hailstorm that will destroy your crop. Same place. It'll be the same place. Unpredictably, no meteorological system is able to predict these extreme events. Extreme events are, of course, intense heat, extended and intense drought, intense rain in very, very short term, which is what's leading to flooding combined with the cementification of the soil, where water has no place to go. And that's why every place is getting flooded. Forest management based on glyphosate and Roundup, for which 1,600 cases are being fought in American courts because it leads to cancer. But they're burning the forest with glyphosate, and it's a desiccant. So the forest will burn, and climate havoc will add to it. So climate havoc is adding to the prior destruction that's being caused to the earth by a mentality of a war against the earth. And so I'm very happy that the COP on biodiversity this year, which will be in Colombia, has been dedicated to the theme making peace with the earth. And we all need to make peace with the earth. And having lived in an India pre-globalization, pre-fossil fuels, I can tell you, it's a good life. The fact that fossil fuels bring us civilization is the first step. It just fossilizes our mind into a mechanistic code. It fossilizes our hearts to not have feeling for each other in the earth, and worst.
In harsh honesty, many people in the West concerned about the climate crisis still think climate justice is a wishful add-on. It's something we'd like to work on maybe later after the energy transition. Your thoughts on the role of climate justice, Vandana?
Well, first, you know, in the introduction of my new book, I have mentioned that U.S. is getting polarized around the climate discussion, like it's polarized on everything. Because on the one hand, you have extreme climate deniers, like nothing is happening in the world. We witnessed it. India suffers the worst flooding, the worst cyclones, the long extent. We suffer it. And my learning on climate change is both, of course, following the science, but most importantly, witnessing and living with the experiences. So there's a denialist. But there is the opportunist like the Gates who want to use the climate disaster they have created. 1% is responsible for 60% of the emissions of the planet. They are the ones who should be paying. Polluter pays is another agreement, another principle that came out of the Earth Summit. And yet Mr. Gates is trying to hijack the whole planet with geoengineering. And for those who say, oh, this conspiracy theory, just read the reports. Read the dimming the sun reports. Read owning the climate reports. The second is genetic engineering in a big way. He has just entered India in a very big way and shifting our agriculture system to do everything wrong. Herbicide resistant basmati. I come from the valley of famous for basmati. And they want to add poisons to it, which gives colon and bladder cancer. What is this insanity? So between these two extremes of the opportunists and the deniers, people working for climate justice are basically saying we need to be fair to the earth. We need to be fair to those who suffer the impact of climate change. And we definitely need accountability for the corporations. I think the big issue now in democracy is accountability for corporations who are destroying both the planet and our health. And they are working, like Bayer has just started to work in America to get laws passed so they have no liability, that no one can make them accountable for the cancer they bring you, that no one can take them to court. This is a system of absolute injustice, the rule of injustice. And so for the Americans, I say, you know, you're an important democracy. Don't hand over your rights to criminal corporations. Defend them from the local to the national level.
Rich countries have research stations in Antarctica, and northern media watch the Arctic, but there is widespread ignorance of disappearing ice in the Himalayas. What should we know about climate change and the third pole? And I know you wrote a book about this about 15 years ago, but it's ongoing. Tell us about it, please.
Yeah. So, you know, before the Copenhagen summit, which is when the legally binding treaty was killed, and Paris was merely a gathering of volunteer commitments. It wasn't, you know, laws are supposed to be legally binding. We did both research, deep research, with the top climatologists, with the top glaciologists, but with local communities who know this glacier used to be 25 meters thick and now it's 1 meter. Because from the ground, you get the witnesses. Right now, the people of Ladakh who live only on glaciers because it's a high altitude desert, they have no rain. It's the glaciers that melt and give them the little bit of water with which they grow their food. They're on a march all the way from Ladakh, from the top of the Indian map to Delhi. They're walking. They're working for climate justice and waking the world up to the climate disaster at the third pole because glaciers are disappearing. In other places, glaciers are melting. In 2013, we had a disaster in my region where the glacier melted. And along the valley, they're building dam on dam on dam, excavating the mountains. The combination of dam building and the ruins from dam building and the glacial flood and heavy rains added up to a disaster that killed 20,000 people. They just got washed away. Schools got washed away. Bridges got washed away. We had to build little bridges for the students to be able to walk across. Otherwise, they were walking 8 miles and not being able to attend school. So climate disasters in the third pole. The third pole is an inhabited pole. There are people here. Second, it supplies water to half of humanity. Half of humanity gets its water from the Himalaya. And we're destroying this water source that nature has given us by being irresponsible to the earth and her climate system.
So do you think that climate science, as it's now constituted and as it's used by bodies like the IPCC, is it a tool still for domination of women, people of color, and of nature? What do you think?
Well, you know, so-called climate science, most of it is built on a lot of modeling. And modeling are good add-ups to real experience. And to me, real science comes from knowing how systems are working and living systems are working. So living systems are still missing. Gaia is a living planet. Gaia is Mother Earth. The living systems and their living laws are missing. It's the climate discussion overall, and the media has a role in it, has reduced the complex disturbances to the Earth to one indicator alone. You know, when you are fatally sick, of course your temperature goes crazy, but so does your hydrological balance. People die of dehydration long before. They don't die of temperature increase. They die of dehydration. But we're not looking at water. We're not looking at the destabilization of water systems, of ocean systems, of rainfall systems. India lives on the monsoons. Now we are on the 26th of September. We shouldn't be having rain. All of last night and all of today, it's been raining. The monsoon should be over. The havoc in the monsoon is causing problems because now our harvest is ready. We don't want rain. We want good sun. So people should be looking at the third pole. And our report on climate change at the third pole, as well as a short film on the third pole, on what a disaster means in the high Himalaya, in the Ladakh region.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. From Delhi, Alex is talking with author and activist Vandana Shiva.
Let's get to one of your specialties, the food chain. What do you mean by dead food, and why is that connected to a dead metabolism?
So, you know, both in Western medicine, Greece, Hippocrates, he said, let food be thy medicine. And in Indian Ayurvedic systems, the oldest system of healthcare, it says, annam shorav sarva oshadhi, food is the best medicine. So food is living, it comes from living soil and plants that are living, and then it goes to our gut. Our gut microbiome is living, it's called our second brain, 100 trillion microbes in our gut. 90% of us is microbes. We are not human cells. And living food enriches every part of this linkage. It enriches the soil and regenerates the soil. And in Navdanya, the movement I founded, we measure. Every 10 years, we measure. And soil fertility is going up where we are taking care of the earth, and it's going down. It's being desertified where chemicals are being used. And when the soil has been destroyed, then the plants are empty of nutrition. And it's the nourishment that matters, not the weight. Weight of food is not a good indicator, very Cartesian. What matters is what's in it, what's the quality. And the living quality then nourishes all our gut microbiome. But if we kill the soil and the plant is nutritionally empty, we are starving our gut microbiome. And then we start to get all kinds of metabolic disorders because food is what runs the metabolism. For me, dead food is food that kills the living systems that are supposed to be producing it, and therefore comes into our body as not just the absence of living food, but as dead food, which is also toxic. And that's where all of the metabolic disorders. Earlier, they used to talk about every part of the body being different, the mechanistic ideal, but they used to talk about heart problems and diabetes and everything is separate. Now, doctor after doctor is saying it's all one metabolic disorder, and it's linked to the food we are eating. And I call it dead food, junk food. You can give it many names. You can create a very colorful vocabulary about how we are killing the earth and our food and our bodies.
You are a world-recognized voice for a vegetarian diet and animal rights. Now Bill Gates, who you've mentioned, is funding production of meat cultured in labs, so no animals to suffer. Is that the right direction?
You know, I'm a vegetarian because I don't like the taste and smell of meat. So, you know, making GM soya into a fake Impossible Burger is still undesirable food for me. And I cannot understand how people who don't like meat want to pretend they're eating meat. Why are they fooling themselves? Second, new studies have shown, of course, Bill Gates does everything in the pretense of the climate. And he speaks nonsense. I have to say, he speaks nonsense. He says, oh, planting trees which engage in photosynthesis? Idiots do that. I build big machines for absorbing the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And then he talks about cows as methane emitters because they have four stomachs. Four stomachs are designed for eating roughage. The herbivores eat herbs. They're not meant to eat soya bean. And the problem is the factory farming. The problem is not the cows. It's how we treat the cows. And research has now shown that cows are part of a biogenic cycle. In 10 years, the little bit of methane they emit is reabsorbed, it becomes carbon dioxide, becomes grass, becomes their fodder. But further research is showing that this pretense of lab food as a solution to climate change is just bad science. It'll need 5 times more acreage for feedstock to feed those microbes in the lab. Just like when they put factory farming, they said, oh, we use so little area for the animals. But they forgot that they use huge acreages for the animal feed. So the feedstock is what matters, 5 times more. And worse, because here's the sun giving us free energy, but not just free energy, then the living systems are creating food for us through what Schrodinger called a negative entropy system. No emissions, no pollution. And by putting microbes in labs to pretend to make your food and then bringing energy from outside, you will have 25 times more emissions than the current system, which has already brought us to the disasters we are facing. So sadly, Mr. Gates used dishonest means to make money, and now he wants to use even more dishonest means to destroy a vulnerable planet and fool the people. And we've written books on him. We call him a philanthrocapitalist. He gives little bits of money, dangles little bits of money, and then takes over entire systems, the entire health system, the entire media, the entire agriculture and food system. He doesn't have knowledge, nor does he have compassion. And those are two other qualities that a good food system needs.
I wonder if we can assign so many evils of industrial civilization to the 1%. I mean, Karl Marx believed that those at the top are just as deluded as those at the bottom. We know Jeff Bezos does not become a multi-billionaire or Gautam Adani without millions of customers buying products, participating in this nature-wrecking machine. Who are the 1%, and does that give the rest of us a pass?
You know, 1% is just easy number than to write 0.0001%. Actually, it's just a handful. The last time the Oxfam did a study, they talked about 12 people. And I used to say, well, you know, some of them want to escape to Mars. Let them just get into a spaceship and go and leave this beautiful Earth to us. And when you say, are we free? Well, when a farmer is forced by a Monsanto and now a Bayer to buy GMO seed because they deliberately destroy the alternate, or a poor person in an inner city is forced to go to a 7-Eleven to buy dog food and junk food to eat because they've destroyed the food system, you can't blame the people in the food deserts. You cannot blame the Indian farmers who committed suicide because they were locked into debt because of high-cost GM seeds. These systems are the 1% who extract rental economy. They are not producers. They rent. They collect rents. They are not just collecting rents. They are working in very devious way to destroy alternatives so that people are left with no choices. And that lack of choice is the death of economic democracy.
I recently spoke with Philippe Sieyès from the Institut Pierre Simon Laplace in France. He told us human interference is turning the plant world from a carbon sink that holds some of our emissions to a carbon source. That means we can't save a livable climate without saving natural systems. You have been saying that loudly for years in books and speeches all over the world. Why don't we get it?
We don't get it because most people have been, you know, separated from the process of nature, and then the fake science, the fake mechanistic science. Tell me how many young children learn that at the end of the day, it's the sun's energy, the miracle of photosynthesis, on which Einstein wrote his first paper, you know, and defined the photon and the photoelectric effect. But these are processes. The sun's energy and photosynthesis gives us our food, our fiber, everything. I have come to it by both building systems, beginning with saving the seed to break the monopoly. We've saved 4,000 varieties of seeds. We've created 150 community seed banks because I'm committed to defending the commons. But through those commons, we regenerate the earth. And the more intense in biological and ecological terms of farming is more photosynthesis, more biodiversity. We get more nutrition, we get more food, and we address the climate problem. All of these problems are interrelated. Why don't people get it? Because we have been colonized by the mechanistic mind. With the Bacon saying, we've got to torture nature, we've got to make her the slave, and we have to use a tortured nature to build a big empire over the earth and an empire over lesser creatures. When we see our relatives at the trees, when we see the microbes, which are such important players in the web of life and in the food web, and we see them as subjects to be conquered and then exterminated, people will not recognize that the biosphere is vital to address the climate problem. And the food issue, being part of the biosphere, is central to both creating healthy communities and societies and a planet that sustains itself and us.
I'll bet you are involved in a dozen projects right now. Where will you put your focus this year?
Well, our focus will continue to be seed sovereignty for the farmers. And wherever our farmers have saved seed, no one is in debt. No one is committing suicide. Food sovereignty, A, to be able to choose their seeds and to be able to grow the foods that are right for their climate and for their food culture, but also don't need external inputs of fossil fuels and fossil chemicals. All chemicals in agriculture are fossil chemicals. For the movements that are very alert on fighting fossil fuels, you need to get involved in resisting fossil fuels in the form of agrochemicals, which are poisoning our food system. But this year, we're going to focus now on saying, on basically, the people are the victims of the climate havoc. And I'm working with communities. Women are anyway are the best reports to tell us what a flood meant. They tell us what a drought meant when they were about to plant. And so we're going to equip them with little bits, you know, of a rain gauge and hydrometers and thermometers so that they can be their own monitors, not just in experience, but also in collecting data. And then from the grassroots up, we tell the climate story, not just on terms of the impact on people who never drove the climate havoc, but also in terms of strategies for resilience. You know, the seeds we've saved, many of them have climate resilience. Mr. Gates just today has posted, oh, only I can invent climate resilience. No, you're stealing the seeds our farmers have already done on salt tolerance and salinity tolerance, on flood tolerance and drought tolerance. You've been a pirate from the beginning in software. Now you want to be a pirate of the wealth of the earth? No, we will protect this beautiful earth, but we will do it with people's participation. And I think this epistemological apartheid that was created, that there's experts and there's stupid people on this planet, it must go if you've got to address the climate problem or all other ecological problems and all of the economic problems. I learned when I was involved with the Chipko movement up in the high Himalaya, the women knew so much. I said, I'm doing a PhD, and they know every plant. They're experts without going to university. So we are going to tell the climate story of expertise from the ground, that there are experts everywhere. Everyone is a knowledgeable person. Every citizen, every worker, every child. We need to get out of ecological apartheid, that we are separate from nature, and epistemological apartheid, that a few billionaires can just steal the right of deciding what's knowledge and what's not knowledge, what's science and what's not. I think that epistemological apartheid is the death of knowing intelligent people and the recognition of knowing intelligent plants, microbes, animals. The life is intelligence. Autopoiesis is intelligence.
You've put a smile on my face. From Delhi, India, we've been speaking with renowned author, activist, and educator Dr. Vandana Shiva. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Look for her new book, The Nature of Nature, available in mid-October. Vandana, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Coming up, why methane is hanging in the sky longer, and the myths of carbon-neutral logging.
Now this week, scientists examined the temperatures in the North Caribbean and Eastern Gulf of Mexico and found that they were 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit higher than normal. And human-caused climate change made these temperatures 200 times more likely.
Marina Jurica, CBS News.
EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock.